ultimately, the purpose of life, as I was saying in the beginning, is not to just get a job. What's the use of a job just by itself? So many have become very successful in business and have starved their human side in consequence. Finally, they just think, what have I given my life for? I was working to help this family, which I suppose I love, but I don't have much time to think about, and now suddenly I don't have the family. So many die not only of old age, but of disappointment, because they realize that they've made a mess of it. They've spent all their energy on job. What's the use of a job? It's only to give you money. For what? For a sofa? For a new car? Why do you want the sofa? Why do you want a new car? Because you want happiness. But if you don't know how to be happy, a sofa isn't going to give it to you. Even people on vacation, I've seen in beautiful vacation spots in the world, acting just as uptight as if they were back home in suburbia. They don't know how to relax. We need to teach people to be human beings, and everything else will take care of itself. But there are stories of people who weren't terribly successful and yet were blissfully happy, and I'm sure that in their hearts, so-called successful people must envy them. I grew up among wealthy people. My whole milieu, I was brought up in Exxon, which is a big company, the biggest company in the world. And so I mixed with all the executives and the people in the upper echelons of business and so on, and they were not at all the kind of people that you think of when you read social treatises. You assume that they're all monsters. In fact, they were, every one of them that I knew, almost all of them, very good people, kind and so on, but they still, their minds were not, they weren't human enough. Their minds were too much on things, and they didn't like to think about higher values. They didn't like to think about why we live, why we do this. They always sort of tried to put those deeper questions aside. I didn't want to live with them anymore. I grew up absolutely determined not to earn money. In fact, I told my father I would never earn enough to pay income tax. And I never have. But that's just the when you see it and you have this kind of karma, you naturally want to pull away from it. It's not enough. You end up, it's shallow. Just a pretty house and a pretty street, and everything's pretty and everything's nice. But there isn't anything great there. It's sort of like Switzerland, where everything is pretty and nice, but there's no greatness. You come down into Italy, where it's sort of squalid, and it's the pits in some places, and yet it's the most dynamic culture in the Western civilization, in the Western Hemisphere. It's from that country that almost every major new thing has come, beginning with the church and the Renaissance and the whole thing of science, and just again and again. No, what we've got to do is give people that dimension, give children that dimension that will make them whole as human beings. And a part of that wholeness certainly is to know how to succeed in work, be able to get a good job and so on. But an interesting thing I've observed is that people who are complete human beings generally succeed better. And another thing I got to observe, very interestingly, is that those people who are real successes, even in the business world, are very often not the people who are too limited. Very often people who have a very broad view of things. A spiritual education, in other words, can actually guarantee greater success even in the way that worldly people want. Think about, just as a very obvious example, but one not very often thought about, that many of the most important decisions in business today are made in a state of intoxication, during luncheon drinks and so on. They've lost millions and millions of dollars from bad decisions made because they were simply too woozy to be able to make a good one. That's only a symptom of something even more. They don't have their emotional life together, and there they are trying to concentrate on their problems at their desk in the office, and they're thinking about their own emotional upsets. If they could just learn how to get their minds and emotional nature and everything functioning smoothly, they would be able to solve things like that. An example of that is Yogananda's most advanced disciple was St. Lin, James Lin. He was the chairman of quite a few big companies and owned several of them. He would sit in business meetings, board of director meetings, and listen to people fighting on opposite sides of an issue. He wouldn't enter in, he'd just sit there and listen. And then after a while he'd say, it seems to me what we're saying is. And he'd present it in such a way that both sides would say, yeah, that's right. But he had the clarity and the calmness and the centeredness to be able to pull back from all the stress and excitement and see that one way of putting it that would resolve the whole issue. The secret of his success was not the fact that he wasn't spiritual, but the fact that he was spiritual. He used to say to people who said that he used to meditate many hours every morning, and people would sometimes say, how can you afford to stay away from your desk as much as you do with all your responsibilities? He said, because of my responsibilities, I can't afford not to. I have to be, what he was trying to say without explaining it as carefully to everyone, he was saying, I have to be centered and calm and concentrated enough to be able to make quick decisions instead of just fretting about them for weeks. Most people think they're working, but they aren't producing. They're just fretting, going in circles. Spiritual education can help you on all levels, even in the way that people need who think that they have to stay away from spiritual education because they want to develop these other things. They can become better athletes, they can become better businessmen, they can become better homemakers, and so on. Spiritual education is training people for life. How many people get married and then divorced? How many people get married and don't even know how to be married in a good way? They don't know how to get along with their spouse. They don't know how to train their children. They're not educated for that. They're not educated for life. They're educated for an office. They don't know how to get along in the most simple, rudimentary ways. Almost everybody gets married. Then shouldn't it be a part of education to teach them how to be married in a good way? I've been appalled even at Ananda to see how many divorces there have been. Why? Because they don't have enough good roles yet. They haven't learned how to be married. They just assume that all they need to do is get married and that's it. It's got to be, we've got to give education on these, in these things. We've got to teach people how to be married, how to marry the right person, how to stay married to that person, how to get along well, how to raise your children, how to get along with others, how to get things accomplished instead of, here on the ridge we found that people are unwilling to, all right, they want to put a point across to the county, and they'll come before the county officials and insult them. How naive can you be? Can they really expect that those officials are going to listen to them if these people are going to antagonize them? It seems like the most rudimentary, imaginable bit of understanding of human nature to say that if you want to win somebody, try to see it from his point of view. Try to win him. Not just beat him down, but they don't see that. They do it again and again and again. The educational system is partly at fault. We've got to start teaching them how to be human beings. And what we're making them now is automatons. In our school system, we have another very interesting approach. And that is that we see that the basic tools that a child needs are, or a person needs to be a fully functioning adult, are body, emotions, intellect, will. Will, intellect. If you've got these developed and functioning smoothly and harmoniously with each other, then you can function as an adult. There are all too many adults who are starved in one way or another. They're totally bumbling in their physical coordination, or they have no ability to relate emotionally to people. They don't know how to be loving. They don't know how to be forgiving. They don't know how to be generous. They don't know how to be calm. They fly off the handle at the least things. It just amazes me to see what childishness is to be found in the average adult. He'll start shouting because he wants something. Shouting may be the worst way to get it, but he doesn't think about that. He just thinks, I want it, and he throws a tantrum, and there he is, 50 years old. Might as well be a little kid in the marketplace, 3 years old. Or they don't know how to think. They don't know how to use their brain. They just sit there passively watching TV, and you ask them a question, and they say, they don't have any answer. They don't have any willpower. They don't know how to accomplish things because they can't follow through in one way or another, or unfortunately in many cases in all aspects of these four primary tools that we need. They're deficient. What we've seen is that there is a certain natural sort of unfolding which takes place as a child grows. The first 6 years, automatically the child it thinks with its body. And whereas you can teach the child to think more mentally, you can teach the child emotionally too, and some children at that age ask about God and spiritual values, and they certainly need to develop their will to be able to walk straight and so on. Nevertheless, the body is the most important aspect. They're trying to get their coordination together. You see them running down and falling and screaming and trying to learn how to handle their body so that they'll be able to work together as friends. After the age of 6, we find them entering a whole new phase where it becomes possible to teach them through their emotions, through their idealism. Hero worship becomes a very natural instinct at that time. And that's the time to teach them through wonderful stories, stories about great people, because that's what will form their whole thinking in the future. Give them a higher ideal of what greatness really is, that greatness is, for instance, I remember the story of Horatio at the bridge. How many of you read that when you were children? One, two. How many others? Not even Patria? Well, it's a very good story. It's only from the history books. But Horatio was a very good warrior. And an enemy was approaching Rome. And the only way they could get across the river Tiber was across one bridge that was there. And the enemy was strong enough to be able to conquer Rome. What they needed to do was destroy that bridge so the enemy couldn't cross it. And so Horatio, in full armor, stood on the bridge, and only two of the enemy could come at a time. He didn't have to fight the whole army. But while he was fighting those two and destroying them, the others behind him were hacking away the bridge to destroy the bridge. And finally, he was able to carry through, he and his brother, and to defend long enough for the bridge to be destroyed, and then they leapt into the water in full armor and swam for shore. But their full armor was just a breastplate, so they were able to swim. But the thing is that they had that willingness to defend their country, just the two of them, and the cleverness to do it in the right spot. That's a good lesson to teach children, even if it's only an outward kind of lesson. But the heroism of being willing to defend, to stand up for, to help, protect, whatever it is, a cause, the willpower to stick it out, and not to say, well, hey, man, listen, I mean, I'm the only, that's only me here, you know, and there are 10,000 of those characters over there. Now, listen, I've had my shift, come on. No, but he was a good warrior, and the others weren't as good. And so he stuck it out, even if it meant his death. That kind of story, a child hears that story at that age, and he remembers. And then when he comes up against problems, he says, no, I'll keep trying. Stories like that, it doesn't just have to be stories about saints, but stories about people who met obstacles, met challenges, and put out the effort necessary to overcome them. This is something that the child looks up to and then remembers later, and it molds his character. That's the time that you can inspire them. Inspire them with beauty, inspire them with music. Their emotions are unfolding, and they're very receptive to that sort of thing then. And if all you're going to give them is the Muppets on TV, you're depriving them. Yes, they want to do it in the right context. It has to be fun and so on. But bit by bit, you can win them to a more serious view, too. Then what happens as soon as they pass the age of 12? You suddenly find that they become rebellious. Well, why do they become rebellious? Why is the teenage era such a terrible time for the poor adults, it's because their instinct is to develop their willpower. And the only way they know it, just like a cat sharpening its claws on the sofa, the only way they know how to develop their will is to strike out at the people they know and sort of resist it. But what they're really trying to do is develop their will. And if you could, if education could be geared toward developing that willpower, giving them challenges, that's the time when they're ready for discipline. And instead we think, oh, well, we don't want to upset them. They're so rebellious already. They want that. They're happy to have that. There is a very interesting example of that in the Swiss Army that a friend of mine told me who was in it. There was a regiment there which was sort of the garbage pail of the Swiss Army. Everybody had to be inducted into the army, but there are a certain number of people who were simply social misfits. And these people, the criminal element and the hoodlum element and so on, they sort of all got shunted off into this regiment and sort of pushed aside. They tried to pretend they didn't exist. And the officers there were afraid to give them any discipline for fear of getting a knife in their ribs. And so they had no discipline at all. And they were sort of the shame of the army, but there was nothing anybody could do about it. Then some new major or colonel or whatever it is in charge of a regiment, came in and he decided he just wasn't going to have such a regiment to his name. And so, since he couldn't be posted elsewhere, he decided he'd discipline them. And all his brother officers were just afraid that he wouldn't last a week, because he was making them get up at 5 and drill much more than any other regiment. He was really putting them through the ringer. After a very short time, only a few months, the esprit de corps of that regiment was higher than all the other regiments in the army. They were proud of being disciplined. They were proud of the fact that they got up at 5 and that they did everything right and that they were exact in their movements and so on. Discipline was exactly the thing that they needed, and so many people are afraid in the same way of disciplining teenagers because they think, oh yes, but then they'll rebel even more. But you know what they're really asking for is discipline. They're wanting it subconsciously. And if they have it, I remember very clearly that the teachers that we respected the most were those who didn't take any nonsense. And the ones that we respected the least were the ones who were trying always to court our friendship, trying to make friends with us. We were friends with the teachers who made us do what we had to do. That was their job, and we accepted it. That's very interesting, because there are few teachers who understand that. And what happens at the age of 19? Yes, the intellect may have developed before, but suddenly then is when children start really asking about life and its meaning, and sitting around in the coffee shop talking politics or abstractions of various kinds. That's when the intellect is really ready to unfold. And whereas it may have been ready before, this is the natural time for it. And we don't need to say only physical education in the first 6 years, only emotional education in the second, and so on. All of them will intermingle, but the sort of channel through which these will be given will be the natural things, the emotional, the will, the intellect. And if for the next 6 years children can be taught in the intellectual way to unfold their ability to think clearly and so on, then they will have followed the natural rhythm of growth. And these things will be in much better proportion to one another. They'll have much better control over them and be able to use them as they ought to when they are adults. The first thing that I was talking about today should be remembered in this context, that education, if rightly understood, is education for education. We become educated so that we can prepare ourselves to begin our education. Life, rightly understood, is education. Education in the school setup is preparation for that process of real learning, which takes place after we leave school and in the constant struggle, the classroom, the battlefield, whatever metaphor you like, of life. So this is the hows and whys of spiritual education. Thank you.